Yes, welcome everyone. Before we get started, Titus O'Reilly here. I just wanted to say, firstly, I've got my show currently touring around. We're doing a few more shows in Melbourne. This is Sport, the Unauthorised History. The first five sold out. Some of these might be sold out by the time you're hearing this, but have a check. It's the 3rd of May, the 10th of May and the 11th of May at the Leadbeater Hotel in Melbourne. As I've mentioned before, I'm currently trying to book in dates in other cities. That'll happen before the end of the year. I can't wait to get around Australia. But we have an exciting announcement, something you don't even have to pay for. After this episode, we will be revealing our new podcast, Sports Bazaar, staying the same, not going anywhere. But Mick and I have a new podcast, and stick around to after this show and we'll have a little announcement about that too. We couldn't be more excited. It's going to be a lot of fun.
It's Sports Bazaar.
Get into it.
Some of these stories you would say that cannot be true.
I'm fine to us.
The hunt for the weirdest.
This is madness.
It's a masterclass in how not to do things.
The most hair-brained scheme I've ever heard.
Strangest.
Oh, wow. You can't make this up.
Things are only going to get more bonkers.
Most unbelievable.
Most genius thing I've ever heard. You say evil. I say brilliant.
Stories to ever occur.
An unparalleled array of deadbeats.
A mecca for colourful characters.
In the world of sport.
Had a taste for testicle soup.
Can I just stop you for a second?
Don't act like you've never done this.
Sports Bazaar.
Opened his mouth and a sparrow flew out. Slept face down with a compass to make sure that his head was pointing north. He hit so many sixes into the members that they retreat into the bar.
I better lie down after that.
It's time for the leaders of the hunt.
It's 10 cent beer night at the ball bar.
It's Titus O'Reilly and Mick Molloy.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the latest episode of Sports Bazaar with me, Mick Molloy, and Titus O'Reilly. How are you, Titus?
I'm well.
Okay.
Very well.
As the antics of the Wimbledon Football Club disappear into the rearvision mirror, we crack open a brand new topic. What do you got for us?
Well, we're going back into history again, into Australian sports history.
Okay.
Remember we did John Wren?
We did. I enjoyed that series.
One of the great
off-course bookies.
Yeah, and led the police on a merry chase.
They couldn't get him.
They
knew he was in Collingwood. They actually knew which building he was working out of.
Yeah.
But they couldn't get him.
They couldn't get him.
He used to disguise themselves, didn't they, as taxis. Horse and carts
would turn up. The police would,
yeah. The police would. They tried every trick in the book but could not crack the code.
So that sort of is like, you know, you're getting into the sort of 1890s and around that sort of period. What we're going to talk about today is sort of a companion piece to that podcast. So if you haven't listened to the John Wren one, I highly recommend people go back because it's a very interesting story.
And a historical document, I would add.
Oh, absolutely. And we had some of his descendants contact us to say they enjoyed
Collingwood in that time. Part of me, you know, people go, if you've got a time machine, what would you travel back to?
And everything. 10 cent beer night, you always say.
I don't like 10 cent beer night. But Collingwood in that era, I'm sure, would be a great idea.
Well, yeah, so the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s, it was like Fallujah.
It feels a bit Sweeney Todd. Yeah. Fallujah.
Well, the police couldn't go in there. If the police, they would go in there, they'd have to go in and enforce.
Yeah.
And so Collingwood's a working class suburb of Melbourne for those our international
criminal
and
interstate roots.
Yeah. Very Irish Catholic, very poor. 1890s was a huge depression. So illegal gambling and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Very rough. Not like that today as much. Today costs you a few million to have a house there.
Well, it's still the last of the inner city suburbs to be gentrified.
Yeah,
it's still hanging out there just a bit.
Still has a lot of public housing and stuff, so there's still some...
But yes, it's come a long way.
It's come a long way, but the richer people in Kew would look literally up on a hill behind the Yarra, would look down onto Collingwood. And they would literally look down on
Thank God they were on the hill.
Exactly. So that John Wren's this illegal bookmaker, that people should go back and listen to that one, who basically by the 1905-06, he has attracted so much attention for making money illegally through bookmaking.
And Bitcoin.
Bitcoin. You were talking hundreds of millions of dollars in the modern equivalent. The forces of anti-gambling people have come together to ban gambling in Australia. This is around 1906.
By that, you mean the church,
The wowsers, they would call them. So church.
Still at it, by the way.
Yeah, the Presbyterian churches mainly, not so much the Catholic churches, but the Protestant churches were really against it. But so were other people just didn't like fun. They didn't like booze either.
They didn't like working class people gambling, was it? You're allowed to go to the races and you're allowed to go to the spring carnival and have a tipple, but when it came to your ordinary grassroots folk, they
didn't like it. So around sort of the turn of that century in Australia, and this is kind of interesting because in America they've just, in the last 5 years, they've just released all the rules on gambling. So online gambling's taking off in America. So we're seeing another resurgence. But this was the opposite. This is when it all went back in the box and became illegal. And this leads to the rise of what we're talking about today, the SP bookie.
Okay.
So the SP bookie is something that for people in Australia would know. It is like, think of the bootleggers in Prohibition.
It's Prohibition.
Instead of having a prohibition on booze, which we never had, but America had, we had a prohibition on
gambling. Betting.
And betting. And this leads to the rise of what is the starting price bookie, which we'll get into what that means, but the SP bookie who becomes, it's sort of this iconic.
A mythical figure.
Mythical figure, much like, you know, an Al Capone or, and there are similarities and differences, but we'll get into
that.
You've got
to find them. Yep. You got to become a trusted client, really.
And there were police trying to crack down on it and there were squads and
It was a caper.
It was a real caper. So we're getting into how that came about and the history of them. Where we probably start is around this time when John Wren's on the rise and the people are saying, in the 1890s, people are starting to say, we need to crack down on gambling.
Yes.
And they start to win power in various state parliaments around Australia.
Yes.
So in 1895, the West Australian Parliament bans bookmakers. They just ban you being able to gamble, basically. This is in 1895.
So what were your options? If it was
totally
there a
illegal.
Totalizator?
Yeah, they had totes then and they had bookies who'd take bets and on the race
on course
and off. Well, West Australia, 1895, banned it everywhere.
Everywhere, yeah.
They just went, you can't have them. Now, the way people reacted in Australia, and Australians are some of the largest gamblers in the world.
I think per capita,
we're the largest.
Highest in the world.
Yeah, most of it's on
well
pokies.
Done, Australia.
But we're very high and everything. Yeah, it was something we are proud of.
Yeah.
So when they burn in this ban, this was sort of a heads up of what would happen in that people just ignored it completely. So they didn't argue.
Yes.
There wasn't big fights. It just never really got enforced.
Sure.
It was, and so much so that by 1899, the West Australian government repealed that ban. But by the 1900s, this is described at the time as an avalanche of anti-gambling laws from state governments are unleashed in Australia.
Right.
So by 1906-07, it means effectively across all of Australia, all states had legislation that basically made it legal to bet on horse racing if you were at the track.
Right.
Right. So you had to physically be at the racetrack.
And then you.
And this is before phones, well before the internet.
Yeah.
The only way you could bet was to physically go there. Otherwise, it was completely illegal to bet off course.
Did that make it going to the course more popular?
It did make it more popular for a while. And the other thing is all other sports, rugby league, Australian rules football, everything else, cricket, illegal to bet on anywhere. Couldn't do it at the ground.
So
just completely illegal.
The horses?
Just the only
the
way
dogs
you
at
could.
That stage, did they?
No, just the horses.
Just the horses.
The only way. And that was because rich people owned the horses.
Again.
So you got this situation in Australia where the only way you can gamble, and this lasted until like sort of almost into the late 60s.
Jesus.
You could not gamble legally unless you went to the racetrack.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you're just not allowed. Now, they think this is a huge win, the Wowsers at the time. They think we have really won the gambling fight.
It's over.
It's confined to the
race
course.
Check, please.
So this is in 1907, roughly, everywhere is in this situation. And this is what leads to, it's effectively prohibition, but for gambling.
Yeah.
So it's a lot like what happened in America. What happens is these people start to pop up that start to service the need of the Australian public to gamble on racing. And instead of being on-track bookies, they are off-track bookies.
Right.
Anyone off-track was illegal. And what they would do is to set a fair price, they would go off something called the starting price. So what that basically means is all the fluctuations before the race ends up with they jumped at when the race started, what the final odds were for each horse
That's what you get.
So they were called SP bookies, stands for starting price. And the reason they did that is it was kind of a fair way to do it because they didn't have, it wasn't like there was a computer screen or even a radio or anything at the start of it
where
that they could follow
them.
They couldn't follow the fluctuations at the track in real time. So to make it fair,
so it's
on
a simple exercise. You're going to get the starting prize,
no matter what.
And we're going to take your bets.
We're going to take your bets.
We don't have to have a run a book. We don't have to set our own odds.
No,
that's
it. Okay. And so and it was all done because they just didn't have the technology.
Pretty brave from a bookie, by the way, I'm going to say.
Oh, yeah.
Because you are at the mercy of...
racetrack bookies, but that's what they did. Now, as soon as this happens, basically everywhere pops up these SP bookies.
What was their natural habitat?
Well, their natural habitat was often a pub.
A pub.
A tobacconist. Some were just on street corners. Barbershops are incredibly...
Barbershops are a good one.
Yep.
Anywhere where men habitually or routinely hang out.
Yeah, you could get an ice trim and you could get your moustache waxed.
on a bet.
Yeah, pool halls were very popular.
Pool halls, of course.
The reason pool halls were so big in Australia, this is we're sort of talking now the 1920s.
Yes.
Is
the Walter Lindrum era?
Yeah, they'd banned, as you know, pubs shut at 6.
Yes.
And there was a 6 across swill, so everyone would get really hammered after they'd finish work at like 5, go to the pub, drink for an hour, as much as they could consume.
I just wish, again, time capsule.
Yeah.
1 6 o'clock swill, just to be there to go.
You would not do well in a 6 o'clock because you have a 3 a.m. swill.
I'll tell you my favourite, what used to be my favourite drink in the world was at the MCG downstairs in the bar before.
Oh, in the Bull Ring?
The Bull Ring.
Yeah.
And if you remember, so you'd go in at either halftime at the football or lunch at the cricket.
Yeah.
And every man would descend on that bar. And it was old day where they just had the guns, you know, the
Plutos
that dispensed the beer.
They
used to line up 7 ounce.
Yeah.
Glasses, and the gun would go down the line, and they'd be 8 deep, blokes would be shouting, and the bar still looked oldie.
And
it's the closest thing I've ever come to imagining what it was like at the 6 o'clock swill. Oh, I used to get goosebumps. I'm getting them now just thinking about it. What a time to live.
So the reason they had the pool halls is they didn't serve alcohol, so men needed somewhere to go when the pub shut, and they could often go and play pool.
Yeah.
Now, I think a lot of the times there was grog on the sly, but one thing they really got into was these SP bookies would set up there because it's illegal. It would just be a bloke. It might be your uncle, might be whatever.
Yeah.
These are just average blokes who are willing to do it. And the main thing stopping the bookies, it wasn't the police because these laws had come in. Now, the thing is the Wowsers had brought this in, they were the Protestant churches mainly, but it was sort of like happened in America. They kind of got the numbers in the parliament.
Yeah.
But they were a minority, really,
in
the public. So most public, were happy to bet or didn't care if you did. And so they just continued finding ways to do it. And the police were left having to enforce this law, which we'll get into, which wasn't very popular, right? So they weren't scared of the police. The only thing stopping SP bookies in the early 20s from really taking off is technology. So there's no access to telephones really at this stage yet. They haven't taken off. Radio doesn't really exist. So you didn't know what was happening on course in real time. They would often set up near a pub, near a race course, and have runners. They might be like 10-year-old kids.
Yes.
That they would pay to run to the racetrack,
get
the results, come back, go back.
Kids came in handy too.
Kids are handy.
They used to be cockatoos too, didn't they?
Yeah,
they'd wait out the front and let you know if the cops are coming.
Exactly. So the kids were often in the, it's good to see,
It's like a training program, an apprenticeship.
So they had to do that. That was one thing, but that was slow. It's pretty slow doing that, right? It's not real time. And it couldn't compete with the thrill of live racing. So people would often go, I'll put money on it at SP bookies if I have to. But the thing holding them back was technology. Because what would happen is you'd often place a bet on the Saturday morning. You wouldn't get the results straight away. You'd often have to come back during the week once you got the newspaper and read the paper and got the results. Yeah. So it might be like you come back Wednesday and pick up your actual money. It was much more fun to go to the track at this point. It wasn't that instantaneous thing. Often what would happen with that was the problem is it gave the time for the bookie to go missing as well.
I was going to say that. That's a fantastic
for the bookie.
Opportunity. That's a window for the bookie to get out of town.
Yeah, so that was the other thing where people didn't necessarily want to bet because, one, it's illegal, so you can't go to the cops and go, I bet illegally and the guy I bet illegally with has taken off.
Yeah, you've got a recourse. Bookmakers are excellent at this. I went to Morpethville once to bet, and there were a lot of Victorians were over there on this weekend, and they knew that, and I won on the last. And by the time I got there, from the race correct way to the thing, the bookie had shut up shop and left course, and he knew. And for me to get that ticket paid, I had to write to the secretary of the South Australian Racing Committee or whatever, get that ratified. Then they had to contact him, and that, and he knew by getting
the paperwork
off,
would
getting off course half of his bets.
Yeah.
Ooh, Adelaide, I've had a very bad run in Adelaide.
You've had some good runs in Adelaide, yeah, though, too. What did start to happen is you'd go to the, if you couldn't get to the track, you'd go to your local SP bookie. And the good ones, even though they were illegal, would be there every week. You'd get to know them and they would take your bets and they were like kind of the honest brokers.
How
of the
did
system.
You find an SP bookie?
It so wasn't
you, it
hidden.
Was a word of mouth? I wasn't hidden. So you walk into a pub and there'd be guys sitting on a stool at the end. And they go, that guy.
It was very little hidden. Like it was, because you got to remember, it's small, like often in a lot of this is in, as well as the city, small towns, everyone knew who the local cop was, right? Yeah. So if the local cop shows up to the pub, everyone would pretend nothing was going on.
Yeah.
The minute he leaves, it's back on, right? Like you know, we get into some of how this happened, but this was the thing. So it begins, as you say, this cat and mouse game between the cops and the cops are like trying to enforce this, but it's a pain in the ass for them.
Yeah, that's right.
They know no one like is supporting them. They're easily spotted. So it's going back and forth like that as well, where it's like, so the good ones, though, they would stay for a long time. The problem the police had, if they arrested one, usually what would happen is two more would pop up in their place. It is totally whack. It's exactly the phrase I was thinking of. It was like a game, a massive game of whack-a-mole.
Yeah.
Because when John Wren dominated in the 1890s and 1900s, it was mainly just him. He was this big, there were others, but he was the big illegal bookie, right? When they banned him and attacked him, they basically, he got replaced by thousands.
Yeah.
Like tens of thousands of SP bookies around the country. Like every pub would have one. Ultimately, the bookies would always win because even if one or two got caught, it's a bit like the drug trade now, you know? You arrest one drug dealer.
Well, that was the Pablo Escobar thing, wasn't it? They went, we'll take him out, and he was replaced by 1,000.
Yeah.
And it was harder to monitor or control or no.
That's right. So this was exactly what happened. So bookies had a whole bunch of tactics, though, to avoid this. So one of them, which you mentioned before, is the cockatoos, the cockies.
Yes.
So this was John Renews. This is the first line of defence for bookies. So this was usually often kids, but sometimes adults who would keep a lookout in the suburb, around the pub for police approaching.
Yeah.
Sometimes they would actively trail police.
Get on the front foot.
Yeah, so the you know something's pretty bad when the police are the ones being followed.
Yes.
So they would pay neighbourhood kids or people if you had a shop on the corner, if you hear something, and they'd send someone that would go around and say the police are on their way.
That
so,
is fantastic.
So that would happen everywhere. Often in pubs or barbershops, wherever this was happening, they would have secret panels and doors set up to hide betting slips and the boards with the odds on and everything. So it was literally like Hogan's Heroes.
I was going to say Batman.
But you know, like
Hogan's Heroes. Hogan's Heroes,
they switch the bed out. The beds are like a, you know, fantastic. One minute it's a mat table and they flip it around and it's back to a bed or they open something up. It was exactly like that, right? Like the ability to like, you know, a secret panel they could pull down, it looked like just part of the wall or they'd have under the bar there'd be a secret hiding spot for because they'd have to get rid of the betting slips or the book that they're logging all the bets and that. So that was a other things that they always do is they would always often have a fire going.
What, so you can just chuck it into the
chuck fire? Chuck the bedding slips and the book into the fire.
This is pre-shredder.
Pre-shredder. So they would have a fire, you know, and often this is before heating, so in the pub they'd have a fireplace.
Yeah, of course.
It was a bit funny when it would be a 30-degree day in
summer. And the fire's roaring.
But that's what you used to have.
Marshmallows out there.
So the minute the police, if they raided, it was just chuck everything in the fire straight the way. The other thing is obviously flushing it down a toilet. But the police got wise to this and would often get a plumber in to block the the toilet.
So the cops are there with a big plunger.
Yeah. Not a fun job.
No.
An example, this was in court in Adelaide. This is all around the 20s. A bookmaker's clerk sat in a bathroom of a house and from the bathroom of the house was a tube that went into the adjoining billiards saloon.
Yes.
So you'd sit, someone would sit in the billiards saloon and say down the pipe, you know, 5-1 on this horse that $20 or whatever, and the guy would record it. Lanny door would be locked, and he'd be in the like the house next door. But there would be a pipe between, and then the police raided. He could just flush it all immediately. So that was sort of another way they got around it. Yeah. So it's like this whole story is how humans. Ingenuity in getting around something they don't want to do.
An unpopular law.
Yeah. Another time they all would do, what was common is bookmakers would devise their own codes for the recording of bets. So ticks, crosses, dots, certain symbols.
Yes.
So anyone else that read it wouldn't know what any of it meant. So
they real prison house stuff.
Yeah, so like you could get the cops could get the book, but you couldn't decipher what it actually said. It just looked like hieroglyphics or something.
Navajo Indian.
Yeah, it's like it's like all these guys probably didn't even pass school or inventing highly.
That's what I mean. Yeah. It's ingenious.
It's ingenious. They also would sometimes record bets on the hand. One that was very popular on biscuits. Or on a small blackboard or cigarette tins. Lollies and biscuits were very popular to do it. Often they'd have something sharp and they'd carve it into a boiled lolly or something. Now, the reason this is you could then eat the evidence.
Or the biscuit. Yeah. That guy's really enjoying those biscuits.
Ate all the biscuits? I can't keep getting raided. I've put on 10 pounds in the last month.
That guy's got crumbs in his moustache. I think we found the bookie.
So that's what they would do. One bookmaker had a pad that he wrote everything on, right? But he had attached it to a thin strand of elastic, right? And as soon as the police entered the pub, he'd let go of the pad and the elastic would pull it up into the chimney.
It's almost magician like.
Yeah,
isn't it? Yeah. So he'd be sitting there and just go. Imagine you're on the seat, you just see coming out of the top of this chimney a book.
Yeah. So that's how he did it. So they're just all coming up. So, you know.
What an era. What a great time to live.
Another man used what was called a mystic writing pad. So it's three layers, celluloid tissue paper and carbon.
Yes.
And if you'd write on it, but then if you slid a metal band down the face of the pad in an emergency, it obliterated
like your exit sketch.
Yeah, basically would write it. So that was how he did it, right? Yeah. So you could write it up. Innkeepers were very important. They would often the bookie would set up in the pub. So he would have like either sometimes a button that would ring a bell if the police entered, or they would like do stuff like pull the lapel of their coat or raise their hat or blow into a handkerchief or all these signs. So they would have signs to show what they were up to. So they would see.
You wouldn't want to turn up with a cold.
Yeah, I know.
Oh, no. We've been, today.
I thought we'd been raided eight times today. One bookie wrote his bets with lemon juice, which was invisible until apparently held it up to a flame. So I didn't know that. I got to test that one, but that's how they did it. Yeah. Another bookie, his wife, would people come to his house to bet. She always had a large pot of stew on the stove, and if the cops came, the betting slips all went into the pot. That's where he'd hide them.
That was her signature dish.
Yeah. A lot of paper and ink in this. I'm picking up hints of ink. SP bookies also did things like you putting barbed wire and lockable doors and escape hatches.
This is
so
fantastic.
They had all those sort of things, right, where,
yeah.
you know, they would barricade it or make it hard to, like, you couldn't really get in the back or something. You had to come through the front. So this was a full cat and mouse game going on the whole time. And we're talking from after World War One, 1920s right through up to the 1960s, right,
we're going
to
go
through. But this is happening the whole way through this, right? The really clever SP bookie.
Yes.
Didn't worry about all of this. He just didn't deal with the punters directly at all.
Right.
So he would hire people who were...
Would just take the fall.
Would either take the fall or work for him, much like someone maybe who's a drug dealer high up doesn't work on the street.
But are they still...
They distribute the drugs.
But they're not concealing who they are?
The police would often know, but it was impossible to... Because they would never handle the money or take the bets, but they would be the one... That would hire, like, you know, might hire 10 people to be bookies for them in different pubs, but they're fronting up the cash and organizing it all. So the really smart ones were like that behind the scenes. And so they were very hard to catch because, one, you've got all this stuff happening, like with lemon juice and people cooking pots of stew and elastic going into chimneys. So it's hard to catch the lower level guys, but then above that, you might have someone else who's behind all of that.
Can I tell you about my, just quickly, a little sidebar?
Yeah.
Well, I was playing poker one night with my friends.
Yeah.
And it was a late night poker game, and I got singing. One of my mates was going very well.
Yeah.
But we'd run out of chips, so I introduced chips, and I introduced a box of Jats crackers.
You mean you ran out of chips for
like
betting chips?
Like betting chips?
Not yeah,
so betting chips. And
so you did Jats crackers?
Jats crackers, right? Anyway, he was winning big, and he had a big pile of Jats crackers. So what I did is I very surreptitiously went to the fridge and got some cheese, and I put the cheese on the table, and I watched him eat about $1,000 worth of chips as he just forgot that they were. Now that's SP bookie style.
That's clever. You're like,
I could have been an SP bookie.
You so
I feel
good.
Feel like I've got what it
there
takes.
There is a real well. One, they like sitting in a pub, so you're already. I couldn't do the math.
About six crackers.
So with all this stuff going on with the security and everything, them doing these games against the police, while these all were well and good, the biggest thing that protected the SB bookies was the police's apathy for enforcing these laws.
Correct.
Right? Because
they're probably up for placing a bet themselves.
Well, the thing is, the police, they knew the general public hated these rules.
Yes.
And had no interest in complying.
Yeah.
The police were meant to enforce it, which they found incredibly hard.
Yeah.
And their hearts weren't really in it. Like you say, they were probably wanted to bet, and some did,
yes,
quite openly. So it became this kind of shadow realm of regulation and enforcement that the police came up with. So
the equivalent of the don't tell, don't ask.
A lot of that, yeah. I just don't want to know. So police would often walk into the pub knowing exactly who was the SP bookie, knowing exactly what was going on,
yeah,
and just pretend they didn't know what was going on, like, and make a big deal. Often they would make a big deal of them entering to give everyone time.
Knock, knock.
Yeah.
It's Senior Constable Johnson here.
Just popping in. Yeah. just stopping outside having a 5-minute chat before they walk in to let there was a lot
great
of that, right?
Stuff.
So a retired inspector of police. Now, I should say all through this, I'm going to be quoting a lot from various royal commissions and inquiries because I've got the list somewhere. The list of inquiries into gambling in Australia, like there's about 10 royal commissions over the last century.
Sure.
There's thousands of reports, right? Like, so it just kept coming up and always found the same thing. So one guy was a retired inspector of police. He was asked at a Victorian royal commission in 1958, why is it so hard for the police to get rid of SP bookies?
Yeah.
And he said, on one side, we have an apathetic public, sometimes even hostile, with newspapers and wireless commentators lawfully stimulating the public mind with racing news and descriptions and creating an appetite for betting, because that was all legal, right?
Yeah.
On the other side, because you could go to the track and bet, so they could...
Well, you're allowed to talk it up. It's a sport.
Exactly. On the other side, a law which many consider unfair and which is without public support, and to enforce it, policemen well-known and easily avoided. Many policemen realise the SP bookmaker is satisfying a public demand, and if he catches the bookmaker, someone else will start up. If the bookmaker is a reputable type, the policeman is strongly tempted to leave him alone on the assumption that the devil you know is better than
correct
the devil you don't know. And if he stops the present operator, a worse one might start up. So this
I
is
totally
what...
I totally understand that.
Yeah, it's totally logic.
Do you know, in a part of town where I used to live, there was late-night venues. There was a move by residents to shut these late-night venues.
Yeah.
But the police countered it because they go, well, we know where they are. We know where everyone is, and these venues are well run. If you tip this lot out onto the street at that time, it's bedlam.
Yeah.
So the police are smart enough to know how to manage a situation.
Yeah.
And if you've got a good SP bookie
who
runs a clean sheet
Doing standover tactics or beating people up or
loaning money at exorbitant rates,
all that sort of stuff, you know. So this was the thing, right? So in country towns and the
Frankston
suburbs.
It was.
Yeah, exactly. No surprises there. In country towns and suburbs too, the police felt like the entire population was against them on this topic.
Yes.
And so they just kind of often washed their hands of it. Not all police, though, turned a blind eye, not because they wanted to enforce the law, but because they wanted a bribe to turn a blind eye.
Okay.
So a lot of police saw this as an opportunity to make money.
Can I tell you a story that I know of directly? My neighbour of mine, Leo Brooks, a wonderful gentleman who used to be involved in a bit of old school shenanigans back in the day. He was a real grifter and a great man, but he was like an orphaned, and he used to come out and he used to stand at intersections and sell copies of yesterday's paper and then run off. But he used to run, at one stage, he ran the biggest two-up game in Collingwood.
This is a gambling game. A gambling game. Flipping two coins,
And he said the cops used to raid it. They'd all be taken down the cells where the two-up would continue with the cops taking a commission.
Yeah.
So that was the cops' attitude to gambling at that particular time. That was between wars.
See, no one teaches you about how corrupt our police forces were back in the day. When you're doing history at school,
no,
they present it all like it's all been a wonderful experience or somehow life is worse now. Yes. And then you actually go back and read it all and you go, oh, there was a lot of shenanigans. There was a lot of shenanigans going on.
Well, they were an organised, they were a legal gang, basically.
Oh, basically.
Yeah.
So in the mid-1920s, the cost of immunity from a prosecution in South Australia ranged from about 10 shillings to £2 a week. They actually knew this.
Right,
like, and usually what would happen is junior police officers would go around to the bookmakers and collect the money. And then it would get shared around the police station, you know, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
So police became increasingly in this thing of doing basically their own form of regulation. Because it was an illegal industry, there was no regulator.
Yeah.
So the police kind of filled the void of deciding who would effectively be licensed to be allowed to be a bookmaker and who wouldn't.
Okay.
So rather than, they knew it was pointless to stop it, so they would select.
You should give the nod.
Yeah, you can be. And then so it might be that I am one in a local pub and then you try and set up across the road and the police
cops
come and go,
no, you're not.
No, we're happy with him and he's paying us bribes.
You move on.
And you might say, well, I'll pay more, and that's where it became
interesting.
All right,
well, now we've got a game going.
Now we've got a game going. So this becomes this shadow regulatory regime that the police run. And it's all local and it's all ad hoc, really, at the start. So police would make sure that there were rules of how you can conduct it. So it was like, don't go around beating people up. Don't lend at exorbitant rates.
Stay within these lines and you're going to be okay.
Keep it quiet.
Yes.
We don't want you out on the streets with little odds. We want you in a back room. Don't go soliciting. Yeah. So it was very much like, we'll let you do it.
The unspoken rules.
Yeah. So this became so big that really its own massive industry, kickbacks from SP bookies and police, and this builds and builds over the years to get more serious, but it's really like everyone's almost into it. And the size of gambling keeps growing, the illegal, so the bribes keep growing in size. So
are the wowsers aware of this?
They're sort of
a little bit aware. They're scratching their heads going, why is this not being raided?
Yeah, there's little bits where they're sort of trying to say the police need, well, they keep saying the police need to do more to enforce this. And the police say, we're doing our best.
We're flat out
collecting these bribes. This is in the 20s still. So it's becoming entrenched in Australian culture. Police are getting bribes and kickbacks. And in the 20s, it's still fairly low money. It's like, it's enough to make a good living, but it's not like, you know, people aren't making insane amounts of money, right? You're like a barber. You're offering a service and you make a living wage out of it. But that's about it at the start of it. One of the problems is it was a very strong economy in the 20s, the roaring 20s, that people could afford to go to the track. You know, because then you had to either like get on the tram or hire a horse and carriage to get to the track because it wasn't necessarily nearby all the time in walking distance. Yeah. And before cars, that was a pain. So people were still, but people could afford to, so they would go and they would bet there. So people were still betting a lot. There was enough money going around that bookies were starting to do well. So in 1928, the detective in charge of the gaming squad in Victoria, a TWC Dealey, said he believed illegal betting had doubled in value since 1924. So in 4 years, the industry had doubled. He was speaking to a parliamentary select committee. He said that no legislation will uproot one of the inherent characteristics of a man. So he's saying gambling is
nature to gamble.
Yeah, you know crime's a problem when police are talking like they're in philosophy class, you know. He said that there's just good money and that the fines are so small that they just figure out it's the cost of doing business.
Yes.
So if they're not paying a bribe, even when they get caught, Yeah. It's such a small percentage of what they're making.
Oh, well,
that
they
go, all right, I'll pay. So that was so he said to the select committee, they're not, this is in the late 20s, they're not scared of us at all. They have no. So aside from the kickbacks and corruption, even the ones that are doing the right thing, this is an example, right, of how it's not even class-based. So there's a guy called Frank Warren, and he set up a bookie in his own home, which is in Wellington Street in Kew. Now, Kew is a very rich suburb of Melbourne.
Well-to-do.
Very well-to-do. And he's servicing his rich neighbours.
Right.
So this isn't
he
like...
He can't be bothered going to the track.
Yeah, it's not like in Collingwood or one of the poor areas. This is like a very rich man
providing a service
to his friend. And one day a Detective Burrows knocks on Warren's door because he's heard of this illegal operation. He comes in Frank Warren opens the door and says, "Yes, gentlemen, come in. I am betting, and in a big way." Anyway, they charge him £50, him £50, and he goes, "Yeah, fine. It's not even a fraction of what he turns over on his
appropriate to the region."
Yeah, so he just doesn't even care. He's like, you got me. Yeah, I'm in a big way. I'm like, he's always like, now then. What happens is the 20s come to an end where you have the Great Depression, which is kind of like a really big cost of living crisis.
Yes, that's one way of putting
which it. Which is huge. Yeah. So the 20s draw to a close. We've got this huge depression coming. And this is where this sort of counterinsurgency to anti-gambling laws of which is the SP bookie.
Yes.
It's sort of this counterinsurgency to those rules. You would think that this might be a problem, but the Great Depression is a huge, enormous boon for SP bookies.
For SP bookies.
It's where they really get established in Australia. They've been mucking around in the shallow end of the pool.
Right.
But the Depression means a bunch of things. One, it shakes up everything, so people can't afford to go to the races as much.
Okay.
Getting there is expensive. You've got to get dressed up. You've got to spend money, all that. So suddenly if you want to put a bet on, people can't really afford to get to the races as much or a day out like that. But they don't think, well, we won't gamble. They still want to gamble.
How do we pivot?
The other thing is it's a chance to turn a little bit of money into a lot of money at a time where a lot of people don't have jobs or much money. So even though it's counterintuitive, people start to think, well, now I need to bet to live. Now, that doesn't actually work for a lot of people, but it is a weird
twist. I'm going to throw a Hail Mary. This is the best chance I've got to get out of this hole.
So a lot of people start to bet as a way to try and secure a financial.
So you're getting people who ordinarily wouldn't bet.
Coming into it, right? And they're all going to their local ones. So they have more chance than ever to do this. Yeah. And so this is getting... Now, what is amazing is around this time, a technology comes along that will change racing forever, and that is, and the SP bookie forever, and that is the radio.
The radio.
So suddenly you can get real-time coverage of the races. So you can sit in the pub.
How exciting.
You can hear the build-up to the race, you can hear the race, and then you can get paid out immediately after the race.
This is the first time you'll hear those sounds of someone cheering on a horse in a pub or a TV.
Exactly.
The excitement. Or the devastation,
the
human drama,
Racing
for the first time.
So suddenly not going to the track is not such a bad thing.
Yeah.
But now it's not such a bad thing that you can't get to the track, because before, if you go to a pub, you can't hear the race, you don't hear the results until maybe a day later in the paper, and then go and collect your money. It's not that exciting. This, the pub would be packed before a race, pub would go quiet, turn up the radio, and everyone would listen and cheer or cry, and then collect your winnings immediately from the SP bookie at the end of the thing, you know? So this was
a game changer.
It was a game changer. Right? Now, the funny thing is the way radio's rolled out in Australia is bonkers, absolutely bonkers. You know how the internet being rolled out in Australia, it's a thing called the NBN for those overseas, the National Broadband Network. You can do fibre to the home, which is where basically the fast cable goes right to your house.
Yes.
Or you can do fibre to the node, which is like a central point near all the streets, and then you sign up with your own thing near that. That is often a lesser speed, right? So it's much like that, the rollout in radio in Australia was as bad as that, if not worse. So in 1923, the government manufacturers are saying, we want to bring radio to Australia.
Yes.
It's a new technology. And the government's not sure about what to do, but they announced they will. And they bring in a set of regulation known as the Sealed Set Scheme. Have you heard of this?
I have not. No. So, and I'm a radio legend in this
you
country.
You are a radio legend in this country. So the Sealed Set Scheme is how radio comes in. And what that meant is under the scheme, each radio station would sell radios to customers that could pick up only their station. Right. So you didn't have a radio that you could turn the dial.
You had to subscribe to a station.
Basically, you had to buy a radio, a physical radio, but it would only pick up one frequency. It couldn't be changed. It wasn't built to be able to go up and down.
That'd be a better rating system.
Very good rating system, right?
Which is sketchy at best.
So if you wanted to listen, that meant the stations made money from selling the sets.
Yeah.
That's instead of just pure advertising, they would make money from if you wanted to like sign up to that radio station, you had to buy their thing. So the idea would be if you wanted to listen to five different radio stations, you'd have to own five different radios. So
this is insane.
That's how radio started in Australia, right? And you couldn't really modify them because they were built in a way that you couldn't really to build your own radio set that could pick up every station was very expensive and you had to really know what you were doing because this was at the beginning of radio. So Australia's first radio station went to air in 23rd of November 1923. It was called 2SB in Sydney, later called 2BL, and then it became ABC Sydney. Straight away, one of the first things ever broadcast was a horse race, which some say is possibly the first ever broadcast on radio in the world, but we don't know for sure. Arnold Ike Treloar called a Port Adelaide meeting on SCL Adelaide, and it was viewed as a bit of a novelty. But the calling of races, it soon became really popular and regulations and legislations had to pop up around racing radio broadcasts. But by July 1924, just a year into it, the sealed set scheme's dead in the water. The public just don't pick up on, they just don't take up radio because why buy?
Or buy a radio.
Radio. So it gets canned and so suddenly you could buy a radio that would pick up all the stations, which blew people's minds. Like now to us, it's like,
it's
what?
Like, it's like the internet. That is like the internet.
It's like the it was.
It's like AI.
So this leads to people getting rid of the sealed set one leads to when radio really picks up in Australia. So in New South Wales, the number of radios was just over 25,000 in 1923. About 10 years later, it was 500,000. So it just explodes in sort of
that
popularity.
Is
for SP bookies, this is a huge boon. Suddenly every pub has a radio. Everyone could listen in real time. The SP bookie could pick up on all the excitement of wagering in the real time and everything, pay out in real time, all that sort of stuff. Hundreds of people would crowd the bar when a race was. So often it was massive betting plunges in the final moments. It would mean the SP bookie might have to have two or three clerks working in the pub.
It's like the stock exchange or something. Yeah.
And often it would be spilling into the streets.
So it would be a mad rush. There'd be peak times.
Peak times. Like the race is about to get, you got to get on before the thing. So that would all happen. The racing industry is up in arms because people aren't going to the track. But now with the radio, they're even more not going to the track.
Yeah.
So the depression and radio. Give you an idea of what that was. Between 1929 and 1934, so in this early first bit of the Great Depression, in Kensington and New South Wales, the race course there, they had a drop in their average attendance from about just over 7,000 every time to 4,000, and which meant that they were making £14,000 every race day before this all happened, and by 1934 they were earning £4,000. All that money that they've dropped, about £10,000, you know, every day, is going to local SP bookies. So it's they're getting the majority of it, right? So the race clubs respond by banning race callers from their tracks.
What?
So they say you're not allowed on our tracks to call the races to the radio people.
But they still call it live on the track?
No, so they ban the radio people from the track so they can't see the race.
Right.
Radio stations get race callers to watch the races from, they'd get a truck and park it up next to the fence or they'd rent apartments alongside the racetrack.
That have got a direct line of sight.
So they would go around it. Governments cared about the decline in tracks because they could tax the track of gambling because that was legal. So they weren't happy. So they were trying to work out how to limit radio broadcasting. So they started to pass laws about the amount of information that could be broadcast about.
Yes.
So they might say, well, you can't broadcast odds or you can't broadcast the names of jockeys. Or they come out with all these different ways to try and decrease it, right? But they're always a bit the step behind. Radio stations found clever ways to get around it. They'd find any loopholes, but they'd also use codes.
Right.
So they'd call jockeys by nicknames or all that sort of stuff. So it was this another arms race of who could be ahead of the other one. And they didn't really like it because newspapers and radio stations, who were very powerful, because it was before TV, they were saying to the politicians, we hate these laws. You know, this isn't Russia. Why are you banning free speech? Yes. And we will run bad stories about you until you let us have this, because there's a lot of money in this for us.
Yeah.
So it became this real problem that racing clubs and the government found it hard to decide what to do, right? So in a 936 Royal Commission in Queensland, someone said, the evidence points to the fact that in this matter, the racing clubs are on the horns of a dilemma. They do not desire their races to be broadcast, but it seems they must either grant the right and get some money recompense, therefore, or allow proceedings to be broadcast from outside the race course without the obligation on the part of the Broadcasting Commission to pay any fee for the privilege. So they're basically saying they've got no choice, really.
Yeah.
They have to kind of accept it. So radio wins. By the mid-1930s, radio broadcasting of races is set in stone. And this, combined with the Great Depression, sets off a huge boom for the SP bookie.
The golden era.
Golden era. Now, just to give you an idea, though, of how there's always someone who's a step ahead of the game.
Yes.
In 1939, a guy called Harry Solomon, who was a race caller for Melbourne's 3XY.
Yes.
He is calling a race. What he does is he, before the race, he cuts the wires to all the other radio stations at the track. So his is the only broadcast that goes out.
Yes.
He then makes a calls a made-up version of the race.
Oh, no.
Which in it, the horse that he had put money on, which was Buoyancy, in the Phantom Call wins. So no one really calls the real race in real time, right?
Yes.
And his is the only broadcast that works because the rest of all going, why is our radio broadcast not going out? And it's because he's sabotaged it. So it was paying 6-1. So the minute the race, he finishes, the Phantom Call goes out that he calls. The real race is running in front of him, but he just doesn't call that race.
Yeah.
Buoyancy doesn't win, but he says, Buoyancy has won. The minute he finishes, he rushes off track to the SP bookie, picks up his money, and then the police find out what had actually happened. Because people did see the actual race, it was actually run. They find him 6 months later in Fiji. So
everything about it is creating a little chonky pocket industry.
So where we are now is, we might leave it there and come back in the next episode, but where we are now is you've got the SP bookies are well entrenched in Australia.
Yes.
They've got radio that brings it live and real.
Yep.
Got lots of money. They're everywhere. When we come back, we're going to get into... the government's trying to fight back against them. We're
going to
get in the wowsers, and we're going to get into the arrival of the phone that is one of the biggest moments and will fundamentally change and make it even crazier of how they go around getting caught with the next installment.
All right, Titus, I'll rejoin you for the conclusion of this story.
We got a big announcement.
What is it?
And we've teased it to some.
We're splitting up. We're going our own ways. I don't know.
No, no. If anything, we're
engaged.
Deeply, we're deeper commitment to each
other. What? We're recommitting our vows. In what sense?
Well, we're like you're assuming the role you don't know. We are going to be launching a new podcast.
What is it?
This week on Wednesday.
Shut up.
Yep. Well, called Animal Bazaar.
What's that about?
Well, it's about bizarre animal stories.
Oh, fantastic.
You'll love it because it was your idea.
Well, the animal kingdom never disappoints.
You've
always throwing up some stuff. And you pick an animal in the animal, I'll go with you, and I'll tell you something ludicrous about that animal. Oh. So we won't do it here and there.
No, but
how do people follow it? Favorite
comedy animal, though? You've got one.
The duck is up there, the Shetland pony.
Shetland pony.
My favorite.
That's your favorite.
I'd go the goose. I'd go the wombat. Donkey. Donkey's good.
Exactly.
Raccoons are a good comedy animal. Don't you worry about that. Some of them are just funnier than others.
They are.
Jack Russell. I would name them all.
So each week we pick crazy animal stories. We're going to tell them to each other. We're like David Attenborough if he didn't fact check or have knowledge of anything.
That's right. Don't hold us to account. Don't quote us
in a thesis.
This is not the National Geographic channel.
Now, the good news is it's on this feed that you're already subscribed to if you're listening to this.
How does that work?
So you're going to get Sports Bazaar every single Monday. No change to Sports Bazaar. We're still doing
business
as usual. Still committed. Business as usual. This is on top of it. On Wednesday, we have got Animal Bazaar will drop it. So every week you get two podcasts from us now. If you're a member, you want to join as a member, you actually get the bonus as well. So you could have three.
Oh, then you're just knee deep in Bazaar.
So we'd love people
What's
to
our first
listen.
Episode?
Yeah. Our first episode, or we go in deep on penguins.
There's a comedy animal for you, right?
Penguins that got too cold. And penguins with
give it away.
A whole bunch. So love to hear people's feedback. If you've got funny animal stories, send them into
please.
Us. We'd love to hear them. And we're excited about it. We've got lots of ideas for different topics
we're going
to cover
Wednesday.
In the future. They're this Wednesday. So you'll just get it on this feed. And stay tuned. No change to Sports Bazaar. It's important people know that we've fully committed that to. We just we love talking to each other and we love animals. So listen, Animal Bazaar this Wednesday. We'll see you there.